So Matt, so actually, so I haven't done my homework well. So I know I've met Matt at different places in the past, and he's been, sorry.
Okay, so, I'm going to go ahead and introduce myself.
He's a professor at McGill, and he's an experimentalist working on Tafel telescope as well as lots of other great experiments. I'm not going to embarrass myself anymore.
Okay, so actually I started out at McGill as an undergrad, where I had the pleasure of being taught general relativity by Rob Myers.
And Cliff, I don't think you taught me anything.
And I'm not going to say whether or not I took any courses with you.
And
I have to turn it on.
So I'm the reason he's not a theorist.
So naturally, after my time at McGill, I decided to go into experimental physics.
And I did a PhD in high energy particle physics
before I went to Lawrence Berkeley Lab and started to do cosmology, which is also high energy physics, I guess. Today, what I'm going to tell you about is experimental windows on the expansion history of the universe. And what that really means is that Jeff McMahon was here last week and told you all about the South Pole Telescope, so I can't tell you just about that. Though I understand a few people weren't here, so I'm going to show you some quick results. What I will be doing is describing the growth-based dark energy test and getting that growth-based test through the Sinyan-Zeldovich effect. And I'll briefly show you some of the results that you saw last week from Jeff. Now those results are submitted for publication, so the new images I'll show you are the final images. I'll also be talking very briefly about inflationary expansion tests, so going after the CMB polarization. I really don't want to spend much time at all on these first two points, because, well, it's just been election season and you've been receiving all sorts of propaganda, and you're probably not sick of it yet. Well, maybe not. So the other thing I'd like to tell you about is a new pan-Canadian experiment called CHIME, which is going after the baryon acoustic oscillations. And that's going to be mainly propaganda, but mainly because I think Canadians should be really interested in this and be chipping in to understand the theory and foreground aspects of it. So put another way, I'm going to tell you about what we have built, what we're building now, which is the CMB polarization stuff, and what we plan to build in the future. Okay, so let's start in the middle of that list with what we're building now and talk about the inflationary expansion test. And here what we're talking about is going right back to a fraction of a second after the Big Bang and looking for the signature that inflationary gravity waves would cast upon the universe. So if we're looking right back towards the Big Bang, shortly after the Big Bang, maybe 10 to the negative 35, 10 to the negative 43 seconds after the Big Bang, inflationary gravity waves would decouple from the other forces and bring forward information about the metric of space-time at that early instance. And on the surface of last scattering, 400,000 years after the Big Bang, electrons would interact with photons for the last time and impart some of that information about the metric of space-time. So that shows up as a net curl component to the CMB polarization. It also affects the gradient component, but the signature is cleanest in the B mode or curl component. So what we'd like to do is go out and build experiments that are sensitive enough to measure this very small net polarization, measure it across vast swaths of the night sky where the biggest signal is the signal from inflationary gravity waves, and learn something about that instant of time after the Big Bang, if indeed that is the right theory to talk about. So what's shown on the left-hand side is a vector field of polarization vectors that has a relatively small, though much bigger than what we expect from the sky, B-mode polarization imparted on it. And you can start to kind of see the curl component shown here. You'd be lying if you said that you could clearly see it, because you really need to analyze the entire field to pull out that signal. This B-mode signal is a factor of about 100 smaller than the gradient component, the type of polarization that you've seen published results on thus far. So the very first results on the CMB polarization came from the DAISY experiment at the South Pole in 2002. Since then, you've seen results from Quad, and the BICEP results have been kind of shown as well. So we've started to see the glimpse of CMB polarization, but we aren't yet anywhere near the sensitivity that, that would allow us to pull out the B-mode polarization. So here's what we're going after. This is the power spectrum of the temperature anisotropy. So the beautiful now cosmic variance limited out to about LO800 results that we've seen from WMAP. Sitting about an order of magnitude or more below that is the gradient component or E-mode polarization. This is the power spectrum right up here in this regime that, that Quad has made fairly good measurements of. Okay, we've seen one or two peaks there. And sitting an order of magnitude or two below that would be the signature from inflationary gravity waves. There's also a curl component or B-mode signature that comes from the lensing of the E-mode polarization. Fortunately, that signature peaks at a very different scale, so a scale of about L of 1,000 or so, whereas the gravity wave signal peaks at a scale of about 60 or 80. Okay. The other important thing about this inflationary gravity wave signature is that the amplitude of the power spectrum is really not well not well known. It goes into the fourth power of the energy scale of inflation, and so there's a big energy band. There's a big band here of possibilities. So we don't know how sensitive we need to make our experiments. And certainly if we build an experiment that's able to probe way down here, we haven't at all excluded the possibility that, that this sort of physics is going on. Okay, but we're hoping that nature is generous to us and that signature is as big as possible. So the experiment I'm going to tell you about today is called EBEX. It's a balloon-borne polarimeter. And it's meant to fly at the end of 2009 or early in 2010 for a science flight, and we're going to fly it in about 6 months for a test flight above Texas. In terms of the balloon board experiments, there's really two of them out there that are competing with one another, and they both have heavy Canadian involvement. So there's EBEX, which is primarily a collaboration between the University of Minnesota, Berkeley, Columbia, and McGill, and there's SPIDER, which is the other half. And one of the things, and that includes the University of British Columbia, Toronto, Caltech, who else am I missing there? JPL, and is Princeton involved in SPIDER?
I don't think so either.
And Case Western. So one of the things I'm going to tell you about in the next two slides is the different choices we've made in these two experiments. I can't honestly stand up here and tell you that we've made the better choices for EBEX, that our experiment is going to be the better experiment, because there's so many trade-offs here. And being an experimentalist talking to a group of mainly theorists, I want to make sure that you guys understand the trade-offs we're making and that we don't really know which one of these is going to be the one to make the best measurements. It's really important that both of these are out there, though, because sometime in the future, hopefully not too distant future, depending how funding goes in the States primarily, there will probably be a satellite follow-up of these experiments, and we've got to know what to build there. We've got to know which of these choices is the right one, primarily in terms of systematics. Is this signal as tiny and well below anything that we've measured in the past for the microwave background? So these are the stats for EBEX.
There's a box on those.
There's a box. Wow, I could use a lot of chalk. And there's even colored chalk for a multimedia presentation. Okay, so both EBEX and SPIDER are now destined probably for about a 2 or 3 week Antarctic flight. So it's great to fly a balloon from Antarctica, primarily because you can fly it for a long time. You launch the balloon, it goes straight up from the coast of Antarctica, circles around the geographic South Pole, and can come back more or less to where it started. The other traditional place in the States or North America to fly balloons is from Texas. There you can launch it, and as soon as it drifts to the border, you have to bring it down. So you typically get about a 24-hour flight in Texas, and from the South Pole you can get about a 3 week flight or longer. The other possibility for SPIDER is to launch from Australia and let the balloon go around the world and land back in Australia. It seems like that's no longer favored for SPIDER. In EBEX, what we're using for our detector is the technology that's looking at the photons and converting them first into heat and then into electrical signals are the standard spider web detectors that we're already using on the South Pole Telescope, APEX, Boomerang 1, and so forth. So we're using old, it's producing its first science results now, old technology detectors for EVACs. And these detectors can see nothing in the way of polarization. They can only measure the total power of the light. So what we have to do is separate out the two polarizations before we detect the light. And we do that with a very simple wire grid that reflects one polarization and transmits the other polarization. So inside the focal plane of the cryostat of this experiment, there are two focal planes. We throw half the light, one of the polarizations, over to one focal plane and detect the light there with non-polarization sensitive detectors. And we throw the other half of the light to the other focal plane and detect it there. In front of that, we have a half-way plate which spins the polarization vector around. So that if you're looking at just the up polarization, in one location of the rotation of the plate, it's thrown to this focal plane. A moment later, it's thrown to the other focal plane. So we have no reliance on cross-calibration between the two detectors. We measure both polarizations with each individual detector. The hard thing about this, though, is that we have just two focal planes, and all the light, all the different colors, go to both focal planes. So throughout EVACs, we are polychromatic in all of our optics. We have to be able to process light that's at 150 gigahertz and light that's at 420 gigahertz and really understand how that propagates through our optics. So that's the big cut that we're taking in this. And that's very different from what SPIDER is doing, or plans to do. Okay. So here we have one reflector telescope. All of the light comes in through one dish that's about 2 meters big. We have a very, very good a beam size from that. Our beam is about 8 arcminutes, so we can see small structures on the night sky. As we put this all together, what it gives us is an optimized state scan strategy that has us looking at a small patch of the night sky. Okay, so we're focusing on a target angular scale between about 20 and 400, and we're most sensitive right around where the gravitational wave signal for the BMOTH peaks at about 80 or 100 or so. Okay, so in this earlier plot, we're going after this regime right here, where this peak is. SPIDER's doing something very different. They don't have a reflector telescope, they have a refractor telescope. And they plan to have a separate telescope for each color. So their optics inside the telescope is way simpler. They only have to process one frequency of light and separate out the polarizations for an individual frequency. And they essentially have an entire other telescope, an entire other experiment for the other frequencies. Okay, so we're betting that we can really get our polychromatic optics down, and that our systematics from that, the differences in the beam sizes and the different colors, the differences in the ellipticity of the beams and so forth, is going to be something that we can control. But the price they pay for that is that they can't see small angular scales. They have an aperture that's something like a meter big, and it puts them down in this regime. So they can just see this peak, and they can't go as high up here to measure the gravitational lensing signature and hopefully subtract it away. And I don't know which of these strategies is better. It depends how big this part of the spectrum is, and also, very importantly, how the foregrounds are patched around the sky. They have, since they have these big beams, they're drawn towards a scan strategy that looks at a lot of the sky. It's good to see a lot of the sky. Don't get me wrong. It's really good to see a lot of the sky. But they can't go for these little windows of where the foregrounds are small. So we plan to choose about 400 square degrees through the southern hole, where the foregrounds are minimal, and make our measurement there. Whereas they plan to look at a large fraction, something like a third or half of the sky, and count on being able to control the foregrounds in that large swath. Okay, what we're doing here in Canada is at McGill, we're building all of the readout electronics. So this is the warm part of the readout system for the South Pole Telescope. It's about as tall as I am and wider than I am. Well, it's about as wide as I am tall. It uses about 3 kilowatts of power and weighs something like 1,000 pounds. And that just cannot go on a balloon. So the main technology that we've been working on for the last year and a half or so is to take this style of readout system, which does almost everything with analog electronics, very high power consumption, analog electronics, high fidelity electronics, and instead digitize all the signals right at the front end and do everything with low power digital electronics. So these are the electronics boards that we've been building at McGill. We're now at the point where we're mass producing these boards. And the total savings in terms of power is about a factor of 10. In terms of size, it's about a factor of 100 or so. So that's the sort of things that we're drawn to for balloons. We also have funding from the Canadian Space Agency to take this technology, which doesn't have very stringent controls on it to fly in a balloon, and figure out exactly what we have to do to fly this on a satellite. So some of the less science-y things that we're after. So that's the part, that's the little 5 minute, 5 or 10 minute section on going after the first instant of time after the Big Bang with the CMB polarization. Well, let's move on to the next bit. And it can be done on the ground. And there are great experiments doing it on the ground. And again, we don't know who's the right answer. From the ground, you have big advantages. You can look for a really long time. You can screw up more than once and fix it on the fly. You can also screw up a little bit and spend your whole life fixing it and not make good measurements, which some people argue is actually a bad thing. But you have the atmosphere to look through. Okay, and the atmosphere should be more, the atmosphere should be unpolarized. But let's say that you have a telescope that has a tiny instrumentation polarization, so that if you have a completely unpolarized signal, a little bit of it gets polarized. Let's say, for example, you have a secondary mirror with beams in front of it. That's going to polarize the light. And that means that even if the atmosphere is unpolarized, the loading of the atmosphere, which is something like 20 to 30 Kelvin, depending on your experiment, might get transmitted maybe one part in a million into a polarization. And that shows up as a signal that you have to deal with. So I'm also involved with a ground-based experiment called Polar Bear. And it's going to be great. But it's a different set of systematics. And I really can't tell you which one's the better way to go. Certainly in terms of technology development for the future, the balloon one's way harder. So it's fun in that way. OK, so let's move on then to talk a little bit about what we have built and about a growth-based dark energy test. And hearing me talking, actually, I changed it because the talk would have been too long. I'm just going to show you results from the South Pole Telescope. And there's the South Pole Telescope in the background. It's kind of hard to see in the light that's here. But one of the things that's striking about this telescope is that there's nothing interfering with the aperture in the sky. So it's an off-axis telescope, and all of the light that comes through to the detectors arrives there without having seen any beams or crossbars and so forth. So you can see right away that when we built this telescope, we're not just thinking about doing SC, we're thinking about doing polarization from the ground as well. We have everything in place for the big expensive telescope parts. It's just our receiver and camera that's not polarization sensitive at this time. So here, instead of looking at that fraction of a second after the Big Bang, we're going after this time from a redshift of about 0 to 2. And we're trying to see, hey, how do structures form with time? And we're most interested in this period down around redshift of 1 and 2 to see how many clusters are out there. There's a lot of information about clusters out here of redshift 0 to 0.3 or so. And there's a lot of different systematic biases when we try to calculate our cosmology and map it onto the rate of structure formation. Galaxy clusters are the biggest collapsed objects in the universe. They're almost linear in their physics, so that makes it easy. And you guys will tell me how easy that is and say, oh, well, not that easy. But being able to take our experimental observables, so for example, the depth of the signal from this galaxy cluster at 150 gigahertz, and map that onto some cosmology is a big part of the challenge here. And most people think that that's a lot easier to do with the Saniev-Zeldovich effect than other observational techniques. So what the SC effect is, I think most people are probably very aware of it, but just to be sure, we have the surface of last scattering back at a redshift of about 1100. And we have our telescope here that's looking out at the microwave background. Up until 5 or 10 years ago, we were always talking about the CMB being this unimpeded image of the universe as a toddler. And that's not entirely true. The CMB scattered for its last time in a hot plasma. And our universe is full of other hot plasmas. Notably, there's galaxy clusters. And galaxy clusters have a whole lot of free electrons. So some of this light comes straight out to our telescope. And a little bit of it is going to flow through galaxy clusters with a typical scale of about an arc minute or so. Inside the galaxy cluster, it's going to see hot electrons. And a few of those photons, a couple percent or so, are going to inverse Compton scatter off the electrons. The electrons have a lot of energy. The photons don't. So on average, the photons gain energy. And what that does is it takes our black body spectrum that we'd see here of the CMB at 2.7 Kelvin, and it shifts it up to slightly higher energy here. If what we do in our experiment is measure in just one band, like right here, what we'd see throughout the whole sky is one temperature. And when we look through a galaxy cluster, we'd see a little hole in the sky, a place where there's not as much intensity in the microwave background. If we're clever, we'll also put a band here at the null. And looking through that cluster, we'll see no change whatsoever. We can also put bands further up or further down. Okay. So what it ends up is that the size of this hole in the sky is proportional to the total thermal energy of the cluster. Okay, it's essentially the Thompson scattering inverse scattering cross section weighted by the number of electrons and the temperature of the cluster. And one of the great things about this is the surface brightness of the SE effect does not vary strongly with redshift or distance. So it's almost just as easy to see this cluster here at a redshift of 2 as it is to see this cluster here at a redshift of 0.2. And that's very different from every other form of detecting galaxy clusters. Another important thing about the SE effect is that it's proportional to the first power of all of these quantities, including the temperature and the density of the electrons. This is different from the X-ray, which is another great way to see deep clusters, which is proportional to the square of those quantities, and so much more sensitive to the clumpiness or structure inside a cluster. I care about using clusters as tracers to understand the expansion history, to understand cosmology, and frankly, I'm not that interested in the clusters themselves. And this doesn't tell me that as much about the clusters themselves, which is actually a good thing. There's less bias in identifying clusters in this manner. So when we go out to do cosmology with galaxy clusters, one of the things that we can do is just count up the number of galaxy clusters as a function of redshift and make histograms like this. And we're very sensitive to the conditions in the early universe that allows the galaxy clusters to form. So if there's a lot of dark energy out there pushing those galaxies away from one another, there'll be less clusters forming and so forth. So especially out there at high redshifts, we get a strong lever arm in measuring dark energy. I promised about a year ago that I'd never show another contour plot of how well we can measure dark energy with galaxy clusters until we actually show the contour plot of how well we have measured dark energy with clusters. So that won't be the next slide. In doing all of these measurements today, one of the most important things, or the reason, you know, the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect was calculated back in 71 or 72. And it was first seen in 98, I believe. And until a week ago, no one had detected reliably a galaxy cluster with the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. If you knew where a cluster was, and you had a lot of money to build a good experiment, you could go out and point at that known cluster and make measurements of the SE through it. But you couldn't yet scan the night sky. The technology that's making that happen today are new telescopes that have large focal planes full of detectors. A single detector is limited in its noise primarily by the shot noise of the CMB photons themselves. So I can't go out there and build a better detector. No matter how much time building a better lower noise detector I spend, I will not do a better experiment because I'm limited by fluctuations in the signal itself. What I can do is do lots of experiments at the same time. So I can take a focal plane of a telescope and pepper it full of lots and lots of detectors, like the focal plane of the South Pole Telescope shown here, where what you're seeing are five of our six detector wedges. And each one is covered with a band-defining filter and some conical feed horns, which define the low end of the band that you're not seeing below the filter. This is a blow-up of one of those wedges of spiderweb detectors, the detectors I mentioned earlier for EVEX. And here's a close blow-up of one of those detectors. Again, these detectors are just measuring the total incident power of light, converting that to heat, and then there's a little tiny thermometer on top of the spiderweb that measures the temperature of the spiderweb. We transform that into an electrical current and measure that current to measure ultimately the power of photons that are raining down. Some cute things about the detectors. Well, the detectors themselves are the thermometer on the detectors is a little bit of superconductor that's biased midway up into its transition. So it's superconducting. It's biased midway up between its zero resistance and its normal resistance. And in order to do that, we give it a voltage bias. So this is just a straight battery in this diagram, which keeps the voltage across the sensor constant. And we measure the current with a superconducting quantum interference device. We keep the bath temperature of the detectors at about 250 millikelvin, and their superconducting transition is at about 550 millikelvin. So one of the challenges in these experiments is keeping the things cold. And then this voltage bias gives it a power that's just V squared over R, and the total power, which is the bias power and the power from the sky, ends up being a constant that's set by its thermal conductivity to the bath temperature. That gives it a really strong negative feedback. So if more power comes in from the sky, raises up the photon power, that will move the detector further up its transition, raising R, and R is in the denominator of the bias power, so the overall power goes down, and you have strong negative feedback. That's new in all of the new experiments. What we used to have were NTD bolometers, which were very high resistance devices and much more susceptible to vibrations, but also much harder to multiplex, which is the next little bit of technology. So one of the problems with putting 1,000 detectors at 250 millikelvin is that you have to read the damn things out. You have to get the electrical signals out, and so you need wires. And wires conduct electricity, and wires conduct heat. And the heat part is a problem. So what you'd much rather do is take lots and lots of detectors and put them on just a couple wires. And so all of the new experiments, ACT and SPIDER and EBEX and South Pole Telescope, use some form of multiplexing. And the multiplexing that we do for the South Pole Telescope is exactly like your AM radio works. We bias each detector with its own special bias frequency up around a megahertz, and we select out that frequency with an LC resonator so that each detector is able to see just one frequency, and that carrier biases the detector, and amplitude modulations on the carrier are the sky signal. Okay, so the South Pole Telescope, as most of you know, is a 10-meter telescope located at the geographic South Pole. It has about an arc minute resolution and about an arc second, several arc seconds pointing capability. The footprint of the bolometers on the sky is about a degree. So mainly what this telescope is a very fast mapping instrument. We can look at a lot of the sky at the same time. What this telescope isn't is it's not a very good way to look at known objects. So if we go out and make a measurement of a targeted cluster, we waste most of our time because only a little tiny fraction of our focal plane is looking at that cluster at once. Okay, so we've made many images of targeted clusters, but that's not at all what we're built for, and the old experiments can do that as well as we can. Well, except that we're really big and we have finer resolution. We have 960 different detectors, and there are three different observing bands. The collaboration involves about eight institutions, including the University of Chicago, which is the lead institution. Berkeley, where most of the receiver work took place, McGill, Colorado, Davis, Harvard, Smithsonian, Case Western, and Urbana-Champaign, and LBL, and Cardiff for the filters. I'm supposed to get that down faster for that part. Okay, the focal plane is divided between three different frequencies, 90 gigahertz, 150, and 220. So our bands, our main cluster finding band is at 150, and there we're looking for holes in the sky, places where there aren't clusters. Just off to the left of that is our next band at 90 gigahertz. Over the last season, our 90 gigahertz detectors weren't very well optimized for the measurements they were making, and their noise is quite high. So our measurements at 90 gigahertz aren't great, and we're going to fix that next season by replacing all of our 90 gigahertz detectors. So when you see a map at 90 gigahertz, you expect to see crappy noise. The detectors at 150 gigahertz are awesome. They're almost perfectly optimized for these observing conditions, and likewise for the 220. The 220 is that very important band where we expect to see no signal from the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. In fact, there is a small signal there from the motion of the galaxy clusters, the kinetic SC effect. Okay, so that will be an important band for going after that signal as well. We're looking through a large swath of the sky through the southern hole, or an expanded version of the southern hole. And what we're spending most of our time on right now are fields that overlap the Blanco Cosmology Survey. So these green squares here. And this season we've spent most of our time doing about 100 square degrees on top of each of these fields. The fields look something like this. On the left-hand side is a co-added map of all of our data on the 23-hour Blanco Cosmology Survey field. So here what we're doing is we're taking all of the data and just adding it up. And you can see CMB structure. Most of what your eye picks out on the scales that you're able to see from the back of the room is the CMB. You can see bright point sources here. And you can see a bunch of dark black dots. On the right-hand side is that same map where we've randomly either applied a factor of plus one or minus one to all of the data. So essentially what should be shown here is noise only. Anything that's really there on the sky will subtract away. And the noise of the instrument, the atmosphere, and so forth show up here. So if you like, this is signal over noise. Let's go in then and blow up four of our best detections. So this is the same image that Jeff showed last week, touched up a little bit. And this appears in AstroPH something or other, which isn't written here. I'm now able to show you the right ascensions and the declinations as well. These are the four most significant detections of galaxy clusters from the South Pole Telescope. This is the first time anyone has published a new galaxy cluster with the Saniyev-Zeldovich effect. And remember, this is really the reason that we're so excited about the Saniyev-Zeldovich effect. We want to use it to find new clusters, to identify new clusters, and then let other people study them. Well, we'll study them with the SC as well, but really to let other people follow them up, to show them where those high redshift clusters are. Two of these clusters are relatively local. This is a redshift of 0.3 and 0.3 something. This cluster, it turns out, is already known. It's in the reflex X-ray survey. So of these four clusters, three of them are new detections. This cluster is the furthest one away. It's at a redshift of about 0.9, and this one is at about 0.8. Of course, I couldn't tell you any of those numbers if we hadn't already followed up these clusters with optical or some other form of survey. The maps that are shown at the top are an unfiltered map at 150 gigahertz. The next band here is the same 150 gigahertz. Our workhorse detection band maps, and then the 90 gigahertz. And finally, the 220, where you don't expect to see any detection, and indeed you don't. Clusters go away there because it's at the null of the spectrum. Okay. The optical confirmations are here. You can see some really nice gravitational arcs. There's one of them. Where's the other one? There's a big one down here. So these are a false color optical follow-ups. Well, not follow-ups. This data actually existed before the South Pole Telescope data, but it wasn't known that there were clusters here from the Blanco Cosmology Survey. And then the blue dots are some known X-ray sources. This guy is known as a galaxy cluster X-ray source. These two are not. So exciting stuff from the South Pole Telescope. So what I've shown you here, and what you'll read in our paper is our detections of these new clusters. You won't find anything in there that allows you to do cosmology. You will not be able to derive sigma 8 from what we've shown you, because we haven't told you how many other clusters we have or don't have. We haven't told you the significance of these four clusters with respect to the others. And of course, we're doing that on purpose right now, because we want to make sure that when we do tell you that, we allow you to derive good cosmology. Okay. And it's fairly easy for us to pick out clusters now. That's not a problem. What's challenging for us now is to figure out how significant exactly those clusters are, so how our analysis affects how big those signals are, and how our analysis affects how big our noise is. So that's why you're not seeing a catalog of extra clusters. We're going to spend the next few months upgrading the 90 gigahertz detectors at the South Pole. So a lot of our analysis team and the rest of our team is going to be disposed of there. And once we get back, we'll really be trying to nail down exactly how many clusters there are per square degree so that we can go out and do cosmology with those clusters. They're typically about 4 or 5 sigma. Yeah. And the number of sigma, not with respect to other detections, but with respect to those four in there. Okay, so are there any more questions about those clusters?
the South Pole Telescope? Yeah. They were not seen in the 220, of course, and we don't want to see them in the 220. They are seen in the 90s, so let's just have a look at that. This is the 90 gigahertz band. You don't expect good greatness in 90 gigahertz because our noise is like four times higher than it should be. Our 90 gigahertz, we have just one wedge, and we're not proud of that wedge. But we see it at the level that we expect to see it. The signal is the right size. The noise is big, and that's us. That's not...
Anti-bullet cluster.
The anti-bullet cluster?
Observations by the Victoria, BC, up in Pumpkin.
We have no plans that I'm aware of to look at it, but maybe we should.
Yeah, I think you should.
So
it is the opposite to the bullet cluster.
Okay, where is it on the sky?
Hmm?
Where is it on the sky?
I don't know.
Is it southern or northern hemisphere?
It's closer than the bullet cluster.
But geographically, is it? Can we see it from the South Pole?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well, let's talk after, and we'll find out. So about a month and a half ago, with our Apex SC experiment, we published sort of the first high resolution maps of the bullet cluster in the SC. So that's worth checking out as well. And you'll I think Jeff probably showed images of the bullet cluster from the South Pole Telescope last week as well, and that publication is in preparation right now. Okay, so what I really wanted to show you is CHIME, which is the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment. We just submitted a proposal for this experiment 2 weeks ago to the Canadian Foundation for Innovation, and I'm really excited about this experiment for a number of reasons. It's great science. It's great technology. It's also a really, it's the first time that all of the CMB people in Canada and many of the observational cosmology people work together on an experiment that's based primarily in Canada. So there's a big maple flag on this experiment, even though there are external collaborators as well. And here what we're going after is the baryon acoustic oscillations, and we're going after it at a redshift of about 1 to 3. So we're looking at the universe when dark energy is turning on, when the universe was about 2 to 6 gigayears old. And essentially all the baryon acoustic oscillations are the very same physics that produces the first peak in the microwave background carried forward through the matter distribution. So if you take the ratio of the power spectrum over the power spectrum ratio of the power spectrum with baryon acoustic oscillations over the ratio of the power spectrum of the matter density distribution without baryon acoustic oscillations, you would see something like this. And the scale of these oscillations is set by the local scale of the redshift that you're looking at. So in co-moving scale, the first peak is at 150 megaparsecs or so. And then as you observe that from here at any particular redshift, that sets the scale of the expansion history. So this allows us to measure that key regime in redshifts of, you know, around 2 or so, where we don't really know for sure what dark energy is doing, whether it's some sort of quintessence, a cosmological constant, or something else. It has a very robust signature if you see it, because there's several peaks. And definitely when you build an experiment to go after this, you would like to see many of those peaks. It is also more or less linear physics. That's not quite true. And maybe I'll have some discussions with people here about how big the systematics will be for that. So it's large angular scales. It should be fairly easy physics to map onto the expansion experiment. If you're a traditional baryon acoustic oscillation person, what you do is you go out and you look for galaxies. And you catalog those galaxies, you write down their redshift, and then you plot power spectra of each of the galaxies. In doing so, the acoustic oscillations have been observed by a number of people, including Sloan and the 2EF. And what they've done is they've mapped about 1% of the volume of the universe, so about 2 gigaparsec cubed of the universe, and they're doing it by going and looking at individual galaxies. Okay? It's expensive to go look at individual galaxies, and it takes a long time. It also means that you're relying on your mapping of the matter distribution, the bulk matter distribution, by looking at these collapsed nonlinear physics objects. So you have to know how to map that physics onto the larger scales, and then those larger scale standard rulers onto cosmology. So a two-step process. The alternative, since acoustic oscillations are on large scales way, way bigger than galaxies, so something like a fraction, you know, a third of a degree or so on the night sky, is that you don't need to see any galaxies. You don't need to take a particular point in the night sky and map its redshift. All you need to do is average a large fraction of the night sky and measure the total matter distribution inside that beam. You also need some way to see the redshift of your signature. So instead of going after individual galaxies in optical or some other band, you can measure the hydrogen hyperfine transition, so the 21 centimeter line, and use this as a tracer for matter. Again, you don't have to look at the galaxies. You can just put a big beam on the sky and average over the entire beam and all the galaxies that are inside that beam. When you do that, if you take the Fourier transform of the time stream that you see, you'll have a frequency spectrum, and the frequency space then corresponds directly to the redshift. So if something's local, like our galaxy, it's going to show up at 1420 megahertz. If it's further away, like 3419 here, that hyperfine line is going to be redshifted to a lower frequency. So by just measuring the frequency that you see averaged across these swaths of the sky, you get redshifts, shells. So you're doing a 3D map of the night sky.
And this is because in that range of frequencies that you don't have other emissions whatsoever?
This has to be your dominant thing that you're seeing. So there are other emissions, but this is the dominant thing that you're seeing. Yes. Most notably, you're looking out through the galaxy, and there's lots of other things in the galaxy that are emitting there. Those things are primarily synchrotron produced, and they have a smooth frequency spectrum. Whereas this stuff is spiky here. Okay. And then you can go up to the acoustic oscillations in two different dimensions as well. So what you could do is take all of the data that's redshifted to, let's say, 300 megahertz, and that gives you a shell of the universe, and you can look for baryon acoustic oscillations in the same way that we do it on the shell that is the CMB. The other thing you can do is you can look through one beam itself and look for baryon acoustic oscillations in the radial direction as well. So it gives you an important cross-check. You better see the same oscillations in these two different dimensions, and our systematics of our experiments, the way our beam shape as a function of frequency and things like that, are very, very different in these two dimensions. That doesn't make it easier, but it does make it more convincing if we're able to do it. You need a lot of collecting area to do this. So you need a telescope that's about 10,000 square meters, and that's hard to put on a dish. So what you're trying to do is build something that can map the sky really, really quickly, and then you can bag a whole lot of photons. So let's take a moment and describe the type of telescope you might build. This is a traditional reflector telescope. And all you're trying to do is take all the light from a wavefront, from some object in the distant sky, and focus it down onto some receiver. This is how you traditionally did astronomy in these wavelengths, because you traditionally had to have a cooled receiver, which was really expensive. You had to have cryogenics to put there. And so the purpose of this reflector, you can think of it this way, is just to phase shift the light. You want to make sure the path length of this light is exactly the same as the path length of this light. So if for some reason you're able to build receivers that are really, really cheap, and you can pepper them instead across your reflector, you can detect the light directly there and apply the phase shift after detection. So all you do here is delay this light slightly from that light and then add all the signals together. And you've built a reflector of sorts. There's no reason that you have to have that reflector then be curved. You could just lay these antenna out on the ground, for example, and look straight up. And if you phase shift this guy a lot and this guy not at all, you'll be looking straight up. If you phase this guy a whole lot and this guy not at all, you'll be looking down here. So the first cool thing about this, then, is if you're able to build receivers really, really cheap, you can look at the whole sky at the same time. You don't have to point to where you're looking. So it's like doing many, many experiments at the same time. There are some constraints, though. You have to sample the wavefront fine enough. So you have to Nyquist sample the wavefront. It's really easy to Nyquist sample the wavefront overhead, because the wavefront looks like this, and the spacing of your detectors can be far, far apart. That's how traditional interferometers with dishes work. If you're trying to Nyquist sample a beam that's coming in like this, and indeed right from the horizon, you would have to have your detector spaced at half a wavelength apart. So we're talking about a lot of antennas. And one of the key technologies that is going to make this, that is making this happen, is that today we're able to get very low noise room temperature amplifiers. So we don't have to deploy all the expensive, high power consumption, large size cryogenics to keep our amplifiers cold. And then we have a lot of technology, particularly from the cell phone industry and the wireless industry, to digitize this stuff and process it. So the maximum frequency we want to see is about 1.4 gigahertz. Oh, your cell phone is 1.4 gigahertz. Your wireless is 1.4. We can't actually look at those bands because they're so contaminated. But all the technology is there to do the digitization, to do it quickly, and do the data processing. So we've now reached a time in technology development when it's cheap enough to do this, where it's cheap enough to build thousands and thousands of separate receivers with no cryogenics and lay them out on a field to build a telescope where we do all of our optics through digital signal processing instead of through reflectors and traditional optics. So a Fourier transform telescope would look something like this. There's a whole bunch of antennas spaced Nyquist sample across the ground. You don't even have to have the ground perfectly flat because you can make up for that a little bit. If the spacing between the antennas is uniform, you don't have to do a Fourier transform. You can do a fast Fourier transform across an entire line. And we have the computing power to do that n log n operation now. We wouldn't have the computing power to take this number of antennas, thousands of them, and do Fourier transforms across every baseline. If we took the VLA and put thousands of antennas there and did our correlations the way they do it with Fourier transforms, we'd never be able to do that sort of process. But if we lay them out on a Fourier transform grid, we can do it. And that's the technology that we're going to take advantage of. Well, it's too expensive for Canadians, though, to quite do that, to lay it out on a two-dimensional grid. So we're only going to play half the game. We're going to use a reflector that handles the phase shifts in one direction and not in the other direction. So this is just a cylinder telescope. And all the way down the line of this telescope will be our Fourier transform line of receivers. So instead of doing that two-dimensional Fourier transform telescope, which would be awesome, we're doing it just in one dimension along a line of telescopes. So in one dimension, in this dimension, we have just a traditional reflector. In the dimension that's coming out of the page, we have a Fourier transform telescope. What that means is that along the north-south direction, from horizon to horizon, we're seeing the whole sky at the same time. We're mapping vast swaths of the sky. But in the east-west direction, we're only able to see lambda over d, roughly, or about 2 degrees in the night sky. And that's okay, because the sky is going to drift overhead every day. Okay? So we're simultaneously looking at an entire stripe of the night sky, and then we're waiting for the sky to drift overhead as we need some.
Are all your receivers on a line at the focus of that?
Yes, and I'll show you pictures of a prototype that has the line in place. It wasn't shown in that cylinder. That was just a reflector. Cylinders are not new at all. In fact, in the 60s, they were very popular. They were popular enough that there's a half dozen or so of them around the globe. But they rapidly lost favor because the amplifiers that were used along this beam were not cooled. And so with the advent of cooled amplifiers, which were necessary at that time to get to the sort of 20, 30 Kelvin noise temperatures that we were after, this became highly a disfavor. So really, you know, mainly what we're learning about the optics of these cylinders and how they're deployed, a lot of it is from papers from the 60s. What they were missing there is the technology to have low-noise amplifiers at room temperature and the capability of processing so many signals together, of correlating so many signals together. So it was an idea a little bit ahead of its time. What we're doing for the Canadian Hydrogen Intensity Mapping Experiment is to build five cylinders, or our proposed plan is to build five cylinders, 20 meters wide by 100 meters long. This gives us a total of 10,000 square meters collection area, so that goal that I was talking about earlier on. Of course, they're oriented north-south, so we can see the entire sky in the north-south direction, and in the east-west, the sky dips overhead. It will be instrumented every 25 centimeters with dual polarization sensitive broadband antennas. So these antennas that are looking straight up and separately looking at each polarization. And then we'll be using modern low-noise amplifiers with about a 20 Kelvin noise to watch each of these antenna, each of the polarizations from each of these antenna separately. So along each one of these cylinders, there will be 390 antennae. And there's five cylinders, so there's a total of 3,900 receivers that we have to build. So at McGill, we're responsible for building the digitizer electronics and the first stage for you to transform electronics. And it's going to be a lot of fun and a very different game for us to, instead of be building one receiver, one mega receiver on a telescope like the South Pole, be building 4,000 of them. And so it's a different game that we're learning as well, how to mass produce things. The parameters of the experiment are here, and I'll highlight just a few of them. Primarily due to earthbound foregrounds, your cell phone and other things, and because the science is there, the physics is there, we're observing between 400 megahertz and 800 megahertz. So that's a redshift of 0.8 to 2.5. And I'll justify that choice on a slide or two from now. We're assuming a noise temperature from our amplifiers and from everything else that adds up to about 50 Kelvin. We're pretty convinced that that's very, very, very conservative. Since the amplifiers themselves are only about 20 Kelvin. The typical beam size on the night sky ranges from about quarter of a degree to half a degree, depending on the frequency. So that's the beam size of the Fourier transform. Our cylinders are 10 by 20 meters for a total collection area of 10,000 meters. There's 390 antennas. And in order to save cost, in order to save electronics, we're summing every pair of antennas together. So that changes the amount of sky we see. If we have just a single antenna transform with all the other antennas, we see the whole sky. Summing two of them, we see about 90 degrees of the sky overhead. So we throw away half of our sky, and it's just to save money. The core collaboration for CHIME is at UBC, McGill, Toronto, Dominion Radio Observatory, and Carnegie Mellon. At UBC, Mark Halpern is responsible for building the cylinders and the low noise amplifiers and antenna. At McGill, I'll be building all of the digitization electronics in the first stage, a digital signal processing. That's myself and David Hanna. At Toronto, they're building the software correlators that handle the spatial domain Fourier transform that I'll tell you about in a slide or two. And that's in collaboration primarily with Wei-Ling Pan and Chris Sigurdsson. Siegfried Steimer is a mechanical engineer that will be essential in building our cylinders and building them economically. So a big part of this game isn't just to build a real kick-ass instrument, it's to build a really good instrument for a really low price, because we have to mass produce it. So if we can save a little bit here and there on our detectors, it really saves a lot. Jeff Peterson has a prototype cylinder antenna that he built together with Wei-Ling and Chris at Carnegie Mellon. And so we're going to use that to prototype our electronics over the next few years while the cylinders are being built. The site for this is going to be the Dominion Radio Observatory in Penticton. It's next to a lot of vineyards. One of the best rock climbing areas in Canada is here, and the ski hills aren't very far away either, so it's a great place to do a postdoc or sabbatical, I understand. Besides that, the radio frequency interference is protected by law, so you can't have cell phone towers, other sort of ground-based interference there, and it's very well characterized and studied as well. So it's a good place to go, especially if you don't want to go to Xinjiang or Tibet or something. To find your low frequency environment, and besides that, it's shielded on all sides by fairly relatively high mountains locally, so it makes for a good observing zone. This plot is a plot of the percentage occupancy of our radio frequency bands from 400 megahertz up to about 700 megahertz. There's more plots that go higher and higher in frequency, but this covers the primary regime of our observing bands. Earthbound foregrounds turn on and they turn off. You can monitor them fairly easy when they're on and when they're off. And what this plot is the fraction of time that bands are used up by other things, by communications. So this part of the band sitting around about 525 megahertz is used up 10% of the time. We should be throwing all of our data away in that band 10% of the time.
So that's how you read this plot. Effectively, the white area on this plot is how often we can do astronomy, and the black area is how often we can't. The prototype cylinders in which we, Jeff has 10, no, he has three 10 by 30 meter cylinders sitting in his site in Pittsburgh near Carnegie Mellon University is shown here. In these two photos, the feed lines aren't yet in place. And in this photo here, you can see him installing the first of the feed. So there are these suspended railway tracks above the cylinder on which all of the antenna are mounted. And the signals are brought off of the antenna. The layout for Chime looks something like this. There are five close packed antenna with 390 receivers along each feed line. Each one of these antenna are separately amplified. Post amplification, we sum two of them together and then digitize the signals. The very first thing that we have to do, since we have a broadband feed, we're able to look at everything from 400 megahertz to 800 megahertz, is chop up these signals into bands. So right on the same electronics that does the digitization, we do a Fourier transform in frequency space and pick out the band from 400 megahertz to 401 megahertz and so forth. So we divide it up into 400 separate bands. The scale of the acoustic oscillations, the second peak of the acoustic oscillations, in frequency space is about 3 megahertz. The oscillation should happen on 3 megahertz scales in that direction. So we chop it up into 1 megahertz and then ship it off to the next stage. So at that point, for each antenna, we've divided the experiment up into 400 separate experiments. And the processing that has to follow that is embarrassingly parallel. We never need to talk, the results never need to talk to each other again until we get to the offline data analysis. So we take each band separately then. So here's the channelizer that does that. We then take each band separately, like this band, let's say at 500 megahertz, and we send it off to its farm of computers, which does the spatial Fourier transform. So it Fourier transforms it along the cylinder and picks out whether we're looking straight overhead or down here in the sky. So it divides the signal up into it divides the stripe of the sky up into individual beams. After that, we combine the information from all five cylinders. So this guy talks to the same thing from this cylinder, and we do a Fourier transform in east-west direction and decide where we're looking within that 2-degree swath of the night sky. So there's three stages of fast Fourier transforms. Throughout every stage of these fast Fourier transforms, we have to keep all of the data. So we have a stage one, we divide it up into different frequencies, 400 different experiments. Stage two, we Fourier transform along the cylinder. And then finally, we bring all of the data for a given frequency together and Fourier transform between the cylinders. The total data rate here is something like 1.6 tera samples per second. It's massive, massive, massive. And one of the challenges we have is we can't yet buy a network that can move this type of data around from point to point. The growth charts for this, the expectations are within about a year and a half, we should be able to do that. I hope that's true. If we can't, we're going to have to scale down the amount of frequency space that we look at. We may have to do the experiment twice, from 400 to 600 megahertz, and then from 600 to 800. We don't need to record this data at this rate at all, because once we've correlated everything, we're just looking at a patch of the sky that's drifting very, very slowly. So although we're sampling at a gigasample per second, we only need to write our data to tape at something like 10 hertz, 10 times per second, because that's how fast the sky is moving. So we have a frightening, frightening real-time data rate. But the end product of this experiment is a data that you can fit on your laptop and process there. It's something like 5 gigabytes a day. Okay. So the data analysis portion, I mean, it's hard, the data analysis, but it's not hard in terms of disk space and size. So these are some of our main hardware challenges. It's mass producing these broadband antenna, digitizing them and processing them, and then transporting all of this data around. One of our biggest real challenges are foregrounds. And the biggest foreground comes from the galaxy itself. There's also extragalactic point source emissions, but the biggest challenge is the whopping signal from the galaxy itself. And the GMIMS survey that's also happening from the Dominion Radio Observatory right now in the same band will be characterizing this, not nearly as deep as we plan to go, but it's starting to measure this right now. The key thing that we have for these foregrounds is that they're smooth. They're synchrotron. They're populating all frequency bands. And we're looking for a ripple at a scale that's much smaller than deviations that we expect from galactic foregrounds. So the easiest analysis that we could do is just take all of our frequency bands and high-pass filter them so that we only see things that are wiggling very quickly in frequency space. And that should get rid of the vast majority of the galactic foregrounds. We also have the correlations in redshift space and spatially to help us disentangle these things. This is definitely an area that a great deal more theoretical analysis and other work could take place. Because I don't think we're at the state right now where we can say, you know, 100% we know how to deal with these foregrounds. I don't think we're at the state right now either where we have enough measurements of these foregrounds that we can say we have the information to know that we can deal with them. So hopefully there'll be a lot more work on this over the next couple of years, especially when the data from DRAO 30 meter comes in. In terms of just mapping area, this is really cool. What CHIM is seeing across the universe is a volume of something like 100 gigaparsecs cubed. It's the biggest survey ever conducted in 3D space, depending how you count WMAP. If you count WMAP going all the way from redshift of 1100 to redshift of 17, because they're able to see some of the reionization, they're bigger. But you know, I have to stand up here and make qualifications like that to say how big this new Canadian project is in terms of volume that it's surveying on the night sky. It's cool. It's doing a lot of the sky. So in terms of other future experiments, it's this black line up here. And it's stretching from a redshift of about 1 up to a maximum of about 2.5. And then we can compare that to other possible computation where the main one here is the SKA. Not going out to as high redshift, but doing a slightly bigger volume. Which one? Yeah, so there's PAST in China, and PAST is a much smaller volume. And PAST is a really funny history because it's an American-Canadian-Chinese collaboration, and right now the Canadians and the Americans aren't able to go there. They're somehow excluded from the collaboration. We haven't seen results, and they haven't been able to see their data. So I'm not counting them. Malonglo, or you? Which one are you talking? The cylinder one, or the? Okay, so there's LOFAR in Europe, and in Australia, do we have it on here? Oh man, the name's slipping. So it's the SKA prototype. Okay, and at the prototype stage, it's mainly meant to demonstrate the technology, and it's not anywhere near what we expect from the SKA. But you know, if it turns into the SKA and you're willing to wait another 15 years, yeah, it's bigger in volume. It doesn't go out quite to as high redshift. What CHIM is it's something 1/100th the cost of SKA, and it's purpose-built into this baryon acoustic oscillations, and we're trying to scoop them on it. We want to do it 15 years earlier. And go after just that one measurement. Yeah, they can do some really exciting other things as well. So I'm not downplaying the importance of that. So the level that we'd be able to measure a statistics only version of the acoustic oscillations at a redshift of 1.5 is shown here. So the error bars of CHIM are these small tiny things, a booming signal from the acoustic oscillations there. The error bars change as you get out to higher redshift and smaller redshift as well. They blow up in both directions. But we should be able to make convincing measurements of the scale of baryon acoustic oscillations from 0.8 all the way out to 2.5. The way that we chose this range, one, it's based on what's out there in terms of earthbound foregrounds. We can't look at every frequency because some of them are used up by cell phones and so forth. So in particular, we would like to go to higher frequency, lower redshifts, because as these lines show for our significance of our measurements in terms of the dark energy figure of merit. So this is a vanilla dark energy. We can learn a lot more by going to lower and lower redshifts. So what's shown on the x-axis here is the maximum redshift that we go up to, and each line is for a different minimum redshift. So the minimum redshift from 3 up to some higher number is here. So what we've chosen is to go out to a maximum redshift of 2.5 along this line that's 0.8. And so by doing so, we're able to improve our understanding of dark energy, our dark energy banana in W and W prime by a factor of 4. This is this crazy figure of merit that JDAM uses in order to analyze the impact of different experiments. And this is after 2 years of observations. We're also able to do a whole lot of ancillary science. So just three examples are to map the galactic magnetic fields and do polarization maps of the galactic fields, to monitor pulsars, and then to detect radio transients as well. Okay, so in summary then, there's a whole lot of ways to go after the expansion history of the universe. A lot of those ways are a lot of those things are taking place here in Canada, including going after the CMB polarization, growth-based tests with dark energy with the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect and the baryon acoustic oscillations. A new pan-Canadian consortium is set to build CHIME, and one of the reasons I'm here is to promote it a little bit. Who knows? People here could be reviewers for it, and now you know a little bit about what it is, and perhaps you'll be interested in chipping in and trying to understand some of these foregrounds or some of the theoretical effects of casting the baryon acoustic oscillations as standard rulers onto cosmology. No, because so many people are proposing to use 21 centimeters to go after a redshift of 7 to 10 or so.
Right.
That's neat too, but we're not able to do that here because that's a very different frequency.
Wow.
So you would build a different experiment. If you wanted to, you could build an experiment that would do both, and it would be really expensive. It'd be really expensive because you'd be going after these very, very long wavelengths together with these short wavelengths. So also it would be very hard to build an antenna that is sensitive to both frequencies at the same time. So we're specifically going after a redshift of 2 or so to go after the dark energy signal. And you could use the same technology, the same Fourier transform stuff to go after reionization as well. Yeah.
You might have said this, how expensive is that going to be?
It's about $10 million.
Over
5 years.
2013.
Yeah. So, you know, you compare that to more than $1 billion to do the equivalent thing going after all of these science cases, like the SK would be, the SK, billion, 25 billion, there's all sorts of numbers floating around. And most importantly, you compare that to the amount of technology development that needs to happen to do this, which isn't much at all, compared to something that has the much broader band fields and so forth. That's 10 years of that. So we can do this science now with technology we have now. We should go do this science now.
And the I don't know what the GSC-17 budget is, but you're thinking of CFI.
We've submitted the proposal to CFI. This is outside the scale of GSC-17. Yeah. One of the things that will work against us is that, of course, we aren't in the astronomy long-range plan that was made 10 years ago before you knew you could do this. So you know it's important that people appreciate that the landscape is changing. And technology is changing that landscape. Also, our interests in science are changing. There was a lot of dark energy in that roadmap.
Why was that? Was that because people doing it were more traditional astronomers? Or?
No, we just, you know, it was 1997 when it was being written, and you know, it was a big, it was exciting, it was a big field, but we didn't know, you know, we hadn't discovered dark energy yet. We were going out and measuring things that would tell us. We didn't know it was going to be big yet.
Right.
CMB polarization also isn't even there. We didn't have the confidence that we have now in the CMB as a probe of cosmology. CMB is in there as a paragraph, but it's not highlighted as one of the things that's going to change cosmology.
Right.
I guess that also tells us these roadmaps are great. They're a good way for us to communicate to our funding agencies and focus them. But things change. We can't predict what the big results are going to be.
Okay, there's no other questions. Let's thank you.